From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Claire Wiley is away this week. Now, for decades, farmers across America have been encouraged by the federal government to spread treated municipal sewage or biosolids on millions of acres of farmland as fertilizer. It was rich in carbon and other nutrients, and it helped keep the sludge, this biosolids, out of landfills. But a growing body of research shows that these biosolids can contain heavy concentrations of chemicals thought to increase the risk of certain types of cancer and to cause birth defects and developmental delays in children, among other things. One of these chemicals is actually a family of them called perfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. This morning, I'll speak with Mike Lures, General Manager of Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, about their biosolids produced at his two treatment plants here in the county and what they do with them, basically where they end up. We'll also discuss the results of research he recently participated in that looked at the presence and concentration of PFAS in fish located within East Canyon Creek. That's in the first part of the show. In the second part of the show, we'll do a replay of an interview Claire and I held back in July with David Kinka, Senior Wildlife Restoration Manager at American Prairie. David Kinka will discuss his work restoring and monitoring wildlife on that Montana reserve. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Hey, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with and impacts upon them. And as I said in our introduction, we're speaking with Mike Lures. He's the general manager with the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, and he comes on periodically to give talk to us about all things wastewater treatment and what that's about. And why we need it, and in today we're going to talk a little. We're going to focus on biosolids first, and then we're going to get to some research he's been doing in the area of the effluent that comes out of his plant, the treated effluent, and goes into East Canyon Creek. Mike, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so like I said, we got several things to cover here with respect to the work you're doing, some of the research you do at the East Canyon Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant. But the prime motivation was this article I came across last week or so, a couple weeks ago, in the New York Times, talking about biosolids, also a material or waste product that's generated at most domestic wastewater treatment plants like yours, for example, and the fact that there are chemicals that are and things that can be in these biosolids, most notably PFAS. That's a family of chemicals that fall under the longer name perfluoroalkyl substances, PFASs. So let's start with biosolids. All right, let's get our definition of terms underway here. What are biosolids, and how are they produced there at your plant?
Okay, so biosolids is a byproduct of wastewater treatment. And what happens is when the raw sewage comes into a treatment facility, the vast majority of treatment facilities feed that organic material to a large number of living microscopic organisms. And we have these tanks that hold millions of gallons of water, and those microscopic organisms eat that organic material, much like a cow feeds on alfalfa. They reproduce, and they convert the organic material to more little microscopic organisms. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to control the population of those microscopic organisms, so we pull the microorganisms off of that tank, we separate them from the water, and we put them in trucks, and we haul them off every day. Here locally, we haul off 1 to 4 dump trucks loads of, we call it biosolids.
Yes.
We take ours to the Salt Lake landfill, and they use it to grow grass, but it's within the lined landfill there in Salt Lake. So biosolids is a byproduct of wastewater treatment, and think of it as a bunch of dead microscopic organisms where there's billions of them in a given truckload.
But what consistency is it? Is it like a liquid, muddy liquid, or is it it's thicker than that?
Think of it as like Play-Doh.
Okay.
It's soft, but water does not drip out of it, so it can be handled and transported pretty easily.
Okay, and again, your two treatment plants here in the county that you operate, the biosolids that come from them goes down to Salt Lake City landfill.
Right. And as you mentioned, the biosolids contains a lot of nutrients, the nitrogen, phosphorus.
Carbon, nitrogen, it's...
That we need to get out of the water because we don't want the nitrogen, phosphorus, and the other things going into the creek. The biosolids also is the point where, say, these PFAS compounds, pharmaceuticals, microplastics will all end up. So these biosolids can contain more than microscopic organisms, and that's where the problem has arisen over time.
Okay, yeah. And we'll dig into that in a minute, but also want to kind of close the loop here because there are some communities, and the EPA has said that it's okay to take these biosolids and apply them to agricultural land that could be used as a fertilizer, because you mentioned carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, other perhaps residual materials or compounds in them that can serve as a fertilizer. Milorganite is the one that comes to mind, that is actually a processed sewage sludge, biosolids, that can be used in your garden.
That's correct. The wastewater treatment process, as we mentioned here, is very much interested in removing the nitrogen and phosphorus so that the receiving streams and lakes do not have these algal blooms. So and this is started back in the 1980s when regulations were written to biologically put recycle these biosolids and use them for fertilizer across many millions of acres of farmland. And that worked very well until we have found out that the biosolids now is known to contain compounds that can be harmful.
Okay, so now let's turn to those compounds. As I alluded to, specifically PFASs, these perfluoroalkyl substances, I call them a family of chemicals. Why is that?
So PFAS compounds were originally developed in the 1940s. As an example, Teflon in 1951 was developed. Scotchgard was developed in 1953. And these compounds contain a very unique chemical bond between carbon and fluorine. Now, that bond doesn't really exist in nature very often, even though there are a few exceptions. And the carbon-fluorine bond that is unique to this family of compounds that we refer to as the PFAS family is very, very strong. Think of it as two very strong magnets that you put a negative and positive together, and they snap together, very difficult to pull apart. Thus, these compounds are referred to as forever compounds because that carbon-fluorine bond is very hard to break down in nature. That presents a problem because when you have Teflon and Scotchgard and all the other uses of these PFAS compounds, and there's some 15,000 separate compounds, so they're in a lot of things that we use, everything from pizza boxes to popcorn bags to Scotchgard to, you know, you name it. And those compounds, because we use those compounds, end up in the wastewater. And here locally.
In that raw sewage,
sewage, and some of it is in, ski waxes is an example, ends up in the water and then ends up in wastewater. So it comes to the treatment plant, and the treatment plants are not designed to remove PFAS compounds from the water. So we do remove some of them, but the ones we do remove end up in those biosolids. And this is where the application of biosolids on farmland has become a problem. Now, you know, we didn't even have the capabilities to monitor the low levels of PFAS compounds until the 2000s. And we're still developing laboratory capabilities to be able to test for these 15,000 different compounds. So this is what we call new science, and it kind of follows the long history of some, kind of like DDT. It was developed long ago for a good cause. The environmental and the health dangers associated with that were not known. Now we're learning that there are problems with PFAS compounds. We are learning that they are really hard to break down in nature. And we're coming across situations where the environmental and health effects are just now becoming known. And that is not science that's completed yet. It'll be many, many years before we get a handle on the health and the environmental problems associated with the PFAS compounds.
Okay. And again, you know, in addition to PFAS's, there are lots of other chemicals that show up in the raw sewage of your treatment plant. So there is not just a family of PFAS, there is a family of chemicals that end up, and the contract that you have with your microorganisms is to focus on nitrogen and phosphorus and carbon and removal of that. That bacteria or those microorganisms, their job isn't to treat PFAS's or endocrine and stuff. That they don't do a very good job at that.
Right. You know, wastewater treatment plants are designed to remove, as you indicated, nitrogen, phosphorus, and other things that you would call common, you know, pollutants. Even though we have two of the most advanced treatment facilities in Utah here in Park City, mm-hmm. our facilities, as I indicated, are not designed to remove PFAS compounds. They're not designed to remove all the pharmaceuticals that we all use. They're not designed to remove microplastics. So when you have a byproduct from the wastewater process, we call it biosolids, it can contain, you know, the one or more of the 15,000 PFAS compounds, the thousands of pharmaceuticals, the microplastics. So we have taken a very proactive, conservative approach in the disposal of our biosolids. We have thought for a very long time that it would be inappropriate to apply those solids to farmlands, which is done by other entities here in Utah, mm-hmm. On, say, alfalfa and whatnot. We just think that's a bad idea. So okay. We have taken our solids to a lined landfill and make sure that they're locked up, because there are many, many questions yet to be answered as to what is in those biosolids, right, and what impact those compounds may have on the environment and human health.
Okay. And again, for those entities that do apply biosolids to agricultural settings, like you say, maybe growing alfalfa or other feedstock type of food, that's allowed in a sense. It's federally regulated,
right,
of course, but it's allowed.
I mentioned a minute ago that this is kind of new science. Yeah. So from the wastewater side of things, there are no state or federal regulations requiring us to sample for or treat for PFAS compounds, pharmaceuticals, or even microplastics. So all of this is kind of new science, and we do anticipate that EPA will finally come up with some regulations on the biosolid use and our treated wastewater that we put into our local streams. That's a couple years away. Just this year, EPA came out with some proposed limitations for drinking water. That was the very first PFAS limitations that EPA has worked on. So there is more to come. But your listeners need to understand that when you have a cocktail of up to 15,000 compounds that, you know, studying the impact of those on the environment and even humans is very difficult, because the rate of exposure, you know, individual factors of individuals, you know, you have a little bit of this one, a little bit of that one, but then next week that cocktail changes. So, and the exposure of PFAS compounds is mostly coming from food. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get a pizza box and that pizza grease does not absorb into the cardboard box, that's because there's PFAS coating on that.
A waxy coating.
And when you go to McDonald's and you buy a burger and it comes wrapped up in that paper is coated in PFAS compounds. So PFAS, you know, if you have a couch and you sprayed it with Scotch Guard, so you have it there. You know, if you have skillets that are non-stick and they have Teflon on them, you know, just a little side note, if you have Teflon-coated non-stick cookware and that surface is starting to show its age, now's the time to get rid of it because that is PFAS contaminated material that, right. that deforms that surface and you want to get new cookware. But so it's really, really hard to avoid the PFAS compounds. There are some things you can do, but it's very ubiquitous. 99.9% of Americans have PFAS in their blood. It's been found in, you know, unborn babies. It's been found to be spread throughout the body and including our blood banks. So there's a lot to be done, and I think you'll see a lot of, unfortunately, lawsuits associated with all this.
Yeah. So we have been, quote unquote, consuming it or exposed to it, like you say, for decades.
For decades.
It's only within the past 10 or 15 years that we've had the technology to actually identify it, let's say, in small concentrations within, like I say, wastewater, biosolids, drinking water now, and our food. And so it's and now we've only begun to understand the public health effects associated with
right.
it.
Right. You know, one of the first studies came out in 2012, which was a medical study looking at the probable link of one of these compounds to six diseases, and that included, you know, testicular cancer and kidney cancer. So, you know, this is all evolving. We mentioned, you know, the laboratory capabilities are evolving, and you'll see, and you're seeing a lot of effort, a lot of money from EPA and the federal government now looking at PFAS compounds. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a lot of research done, and that will continue for some time.
Well, let's get into that research. Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Mike Lohrs. He's the general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. We're talking about wastewater treatment and the plants here, his two plants that he operates, oversees the operations of here in Summit County. Speaking of research, we got another 6 or 7 minutes. You participated in some research associated with PFAS compounds showing up in your wastewater effluent, and that effluent which gets discharges in this case to East Canyon Creek. Talk a little bit about that.
So back in 2014, we were working with Baylor University on levels of pharmaceuticals in fish in East Canyon Creek. So we worked with the Division of Wildlife Resources. We collected some fish, mainly brown trout, and a little small fish called a mottled sculpin. It's a little fish that the brown trout feed on. And we were talking with Baylor University not too long ago, and they still had some leftover fish samples from 10 years ago from that 2014 study we did. We said, you know, let's take those fish samples and analyze them for PFAS compounds. So we looked at 35 separate compounds in the brown trout and these sculpin, and we found that the fish contain 20 different PFAS compounds. And this is, again, from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, 10 years ago, we did not have the capabilities from a laboratory standpoint of view to look at these compounds. So this is kind of taking a real unique opportunity. Hey, what was in place 10 years ago in East Canyon Creek? So we sampled the fish, you know, that we had, and we found, as I indicated, 20 different PFAS compounds.
This is fish downstream.
This is fish downstream and upstream.
Okay.
Yep. And I might just point out, since you bring that up, that the concentration of PFAS compounds did exist downstream from the wastewater treatment facility, as we expected, mm-hmm. but it also existed upstream. And upstream would be coming from septic tanks, from even like ski wax.
Maybe stormwater runoff.
So, again, it shows that the PFAS compounds are pretty much everywhere. What's unique about this research paper that we put together is that here in the United States, there are no federal or state regulations limiting the amount of PFAS that can be in, say, fish that you buy.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, well, let's apply the European Food Safety Authority regulations, and they have certain amounts of PFAS compounds, mainly four different individual compounds. And when you apply the European Food Safety Authority regulations to the fish in East Canyon Creek, we found that if you were to eat 2.2 meals per week of, say, the brown trout, that you would exceed the European Food Safety Authority limits. Now, 2.2 meals a week for brown trout is something that's probably not going to happen.
No.
You know, that, but it just shows that these PFAS compounds are present locally, and they exist downstream and upstream of the wastewater treatment facility. And it's just a snapshot as to what we are seeing here locally.
And again, that's just PFASs.
Right.
And because you've done other studies, research that shows that there are other chemicals in these fish, either downstream or upstream, mm-hmm. Like endocrine disruptors or certain types of pharmaceuticals.
Right. So we've done quite a bit of research, again, with Baylor University on the pharmaceutical side of things. And when I say pharmaceuticals, we mainly zero in on the estrogens because those can feminize the male fish, and that can have a dramatic impact on the fish population.
Mm-hmm.
And we found these compounds below the wastewater treatment plant and above the wastewater treatment plant, and that was mainly coming from septic tanks. So think of any pharmaceutical that you take, a good portion of that pharmaceutical will end up in the urine that you flush. And again, our treatment facilities are not designed to remove these compounds,
mm-hmm.
but I will tell you that we are looking into how to remove it, and we now know what needs to be done. The problem is there are no regulations to give us guidance as to what levels we need to target. You know, how low do we need to get estrogens? How low do we need to get PFAS compounds? So that's yet to come.
And so, just last couple minutes, is there technology available to remove these compounds?
Yes. So what we've done is we've looked at the whole picture. How can we get rid of all the pharmaceuticals and all the PFAS compounds? And without getting into too many details here, we would oxidize, like using ozone to break down the pharmaceuticals, and we would use activated carbon to get rid of the PFAS compounds.
Okay, so the technology is there. The engineering is possible. It's all about the money.
It's all about the money.
How expensive can that be?
Yeah.
And what the regulations will say you
right.
have to get.
We can't put a final cost to it until we know what the final regulations are. But the technology does exist. But yes, it's expensive.
Okay, so as always, to be continued. But this paper. Can people go and read your paper?
The draft manuscript has been submitted, which is to a peer-reviewed environmental journal. It's currently being reviewed, at which time it's accepted in the journal. Give me a call, and I can send it to you. But right now, it's in the review stage.
Okay. Well, Mike Lures, general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. We were talking about PFASs, forever chemicals. I think we should also maybe describe them as everywhere chemicals.
Absolutely.
They're not just forever. They're everywhere chemicals. Mm-hmm. Don't want to be alarmist, but they're part of our own ecosystem in a way. Well, I don't want to get you down another but that seems to be the case.
PFAS compounds, unfortunately, are everywhere, and they're in all of us.
And it's up to us to try to limit,
right.
among all other things, how much we expose ourselves to.
And you know, the goal here is ultimately determine which of these compounds are bad and get them out of the products that we use.
All right, Mike Lures, as always, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. We'll have you back.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll, you know what? I think we may have an update. We're going to have an update on some breaking news here. It's KPCW. We'll be right back. From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. We are now speaking with Daniel Kinka, who is a senior wildlife restoration manager at American Prairie. Welcome, Daniel.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to talk with you because we have been talking a lot about rewilding and habitat
restoration
and protection on the show because it's obviously something near and dear to our hearts. So first off, why don't we start with American Prairie? Tell us about this reserve and then about your position there.
Yeah. So essentially what American Prairie is trying to do is piece together one of the largest protected areas for wildlife in North America outside of Alaska. We exist in kind of north central Montana region, surrounding a bunch of currently protected areas. And we've been at it since, you know, for about 20 years now, piecing together public lands with private land acquisitions to, again, set aside that land for wildlife restoration, habitat restoration, rewilding is a term that we use, and also public access. We want to make sure that these lands, the private lands anyways, are opened up for human access of a variety of kinds. And so public access is also a pillar of our mission. I'm the senior wildlife restoration manager for American Prairie, as you mentioned. Thank you. That basically means that I'm overseeing all of the rewilding that happens at American Prairie and also coordinating with our outside researchers. And I've been with the organization for about 6.5 years.
Well, let's start there with the first part of your position and we'll get to the second part. But I want to know about some of the projects that you have done there that have been successful and what that meant for the land, the environment there when you do bring these species either back or help them to multiply?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of stuff that we do, and I don't have time to get into all of it. So I'll highlight the thing that I think maybe we're most associated with and maybe the rewilding practice that we engage in that moves the needle the most, and that is bison restoration. So bison are a keystone species or an ecological engineer is a term that some of your listeners might be familiar with. It's also the nation's mammal. It's this very charismatic animal. It shows up on the badge of every National Park Service ranger. Mm-hmm. It's really important to the ecosystem and how they function, particularly in the Great Plains region. They are also, in this part of the state of Montana, considered livestock, not wildlife. They are not managed by the state wildlife agency. They're not managed by the federal wildlife agency. They're overseen by the Department of Livestock, and they are privately owned by American Prairie as an entity, unlike all other wildlife. This is kind of weird in terms of how we think about wildlife in this country, and certainly American Prairie thinks about the bison as a wildlife species, as a wild type animal, but legally they are not. What that does allow us to do, though, as a non-governmental organization, as a nonprofit organization, is to buy and own bison and bring them in, very similar to the way that a cattle producer would buy cattle and import them or breed them or whatever they need to do on the land that they own and operate, and put that towards, you know, a commodity production operation, right? Like they raise cattle, they sell cattle, they make money that way. American Prairie operates in a similar way in the sense that we own bison, we raise bison, but we don't sell them for meat. We essentially use them as a restoration tool on the landscape. So when I say that I'm in the business of rewilding and my team is in the business of rewilding, often what we're doing is actually just bringing back nature's original rewilders, or maybe wilders is the better term, in the form of bison, and then allowing them to do the work. Because of the way bison graze, because of the way they operate on the landscape, they essentially make it a home for far more species and for more ecological processes than would exist without them. So simply by buying bison, bringing them onto the landscape, that takes us a long way towards our rewilding goals.
Right. Talk to us about that role that they play in the ecosystem. Is it because they don't stay in one area for too long? They stay mobile. They do what they need to do for that and then move on. How do they work in an ecosystem that is so beneficial?
Yeah, all of the above, Claire. Mm-hmm. And specifically, there's like a number of ways that Bison qualify as an ecosystem engineer, but I'll focus on the one that is most often what you will encounter. If you Google Bison and ecosystem engineer, this is probably what you'll find. And it is the idea, bear with me, this is already complicated and it's harder to do in an audio medium, but they manage the structural diversity of the system. Mm-hmm. What the heck does that mean? Mm-hmm. It means that a grassland is a grassland, right? So let's just assume that all the plants, let's say there's 100 different species of plant, grass, forbs, whatever, that make up a prairie ecosystem in an amount of space, right? Let's just assume that's constant. That doesn't change, but when you put bison onto, because of the way bison graze, and we're not trying to deliberately tell them like cattle, like you graze here for these 2 months and then you move to this pasture for 6 weeks. When we can, we say, just be bison and do what bison do naturally. What they do in a big enough space is graze unevenly. So some areas get grazed very hard in a given year, some areas get completely missed in a given year, and some areas get lightly grazed in a given year. So what you get across this entire parcel, right, of the same species of grasses, plants, forbs, whatever, is a varying structural diversity. Patches within there that are ungrazed, very tall grass, patches that are very heavily grazed and are maybe almost all the way down to the dirt, and some that are kind of like medium grazed. And of course, they're not discrete categories. It's a continuum, right, from like heavily grazed to not grazed at all. And that's important for a number of other species, particularly migratory birds. Essentially, you've got birds that only want to be in the heavily grazed parts of that pasture. And you've got other birds that only want to be in the ungrazed parts of that pasture. And still other birds that want to be in the kind of lightly grazed part of that pasture. So what the bison are doing, just by virtue of the way they graze, the way they evolve to interact in this landscape, is taking a uniform landscape and making it heterogeneous or diverse in a way that accommodates more wildlife. So without bison, you get like the birds in the middle, basically, mm-hmm. under a typical cattle pasture management system. You just get the birds that like the kind of take half, leave half model. Again, there's more progressive ways of doing cattle management now, but this historical classic way of doing this only accommodates the birds in the middle. With bison, or an animal that manages a little bit more ecologically mindedly, you have a full complement of these different types of habitat within that pasture, and therefore you get more and more different kinds of animals. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm curious as to what this land looked like prior to the reserve being established. I mean, we're talking 460,000 acres, almost a 500,000. That's based on my math, that's like 750 or so square miles. It's a large tract of land. What was there before the reserve?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is it looks very similar to the way, you know, Lewis and Clark would have seen it when they came up the Missouri River in the very early 1800s, right? It looks very similar to what we hear about in the oral traditions of all the native peoples that would have called the region home historically and still do today. What's missing is the wildlife, right? Yeah. If you look at pictures, or more importantly, if you come to visit American Prairie, which is open for anybody to come and enjoy, you will see a landscape that, you know, with the exception of the barbed wire fences and the dirt roads, looks almost identical to what any early explorer or any early indigenous person would have recognized central Montana to be. Mm. The one difference is that all the large wildlife, anything bigger than a prairie dog, is either gone are reduced to ecologically insignificant populations. And what it has been replaced with, in most cases, is lots and lots of cattle. So the habitat looks the same way that the habitat used to do. The dark night skies are the same and as dark as they used to be. Mm-hmm. The quietude of central Montana is the same. The sunsets that you can see in Charlie Russell's paintings are the same. But what's missing is the elk and the bison and the pronghorn and the white-tailed deer and the mule deer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in significant numbers ecologically.
How many bison are we talking?
There's 900 bison, give or take, right now on two different management units, two different herds.
Plans for more?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'd like to get to at least 5,000 bison before we can say, like, okay, we've made a pretty significant contribution to kind of bison restoration as a species across the continent.
Incredible. That's amazing. And we obviously right here in Utah have Antelope mm-hmm. Island where mm-hmm. you can go and see the bison. And obviously migratory birds play a big role in what's happening in our ecosystem here. But moving past bison, it looks like you have a project for swift foxes. What are some of the other animals that you're trying to rewild in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And real quick, I'll just put a plug in for Antelope Island and also the Henry mm-hmm. Mountains. Herd of bison in Utah. I did my PhD at Utah State University. Nice. Go Aggies.
Fantastic.
Incredible place. I've been there many times. Yeah.
Good, great shout out. And I was just there actually last weekend. And it never ceases to amaze me when the bison are grazing and you just sit and watch. And there were a lot of calves. And just the family dynamic and what's happening out there is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's incredible. And a really accessible, easy way for, you know, the greater Salt Lake community to go see bison being, you know, mostly wild. But to your question, Claire, about what else are we rewilding, yeah. You mentioned swift fox, which is this endemic, so native to the region, little itty bitty fox of the Great Plains. I mean, we're talking about a fox that's smaller than a house cat in many cases, so a tiny little thing. That was accidentally removed from the region historically. Basically, when people were persecuting wolves and coyotes in the region, the same stuff and the same techniques that kill those larger canids also kills the little ones. Mm-hmm. So they're not really a problem for agriculture. They don't really bother people at all. They mostly eat bugs and prairie dogs, but they were accidentally removed. So in collaboration with our research partners at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and the Fort Belknap Indian Community, as well as a number of other environmental NGOs in the region, we're collaborating on a process to bring swift fox back to the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, a neighbor of American prairies. And we've already seen some of those reintroduced foxes start to make their way into American prairie, which is fantastic and a real success story. There's really only four animals that are missing from the American prairie landscape, like not there at all. Four to six, I guess. It's the swift fox, the black-footed ferret, the wolf and the grizzly bear, bison, if you count wild bison that aren't constrained behind a fence, and maybe river otters, but frankly, we don't know a lot about what was here since those would have been trapped out very, very early. Mm. So the kind of like standard rewilding, the kind that I think most people imagine when they close their eyes of like a biologist, an intrepid biologist, like capturing an animal, putting it in some kind of cage and driving it to a new spot and dropping it off in that new spot. That's not really the kind of rewilding that we're primarily engaged with. A lot of these wildlife, like swift fox and black-footed ferrets and bison, are actually, if you squint, you can find them on the map. They're just like vanishingly few. They're like insignificant numbers. American prairie is really more about turning the volume up on wildlife. Most of our animals are there. There's just too little of everything. So the question is, how do you make more of everything, more than it is about how you do relocation or translocation type of rewilding?
We're speaking with Daniel Kinka. He's the Senior Wildlife Restoration Manager at American Prairie, and American Prairie is a prairie-based nature reserve of almost 500,000 acres located in central Montana. So Daniel, you have your fans, I'm sure.
We do.
But is there pushback on your efforts from, say, local ranchers, are there concerns with respect to an American prairie or a reserve like this?
Of course. Yeah. Some more justified than others, some more fact and evidence-based than others, but American prairie is presenting a new way of managing land and way of thinking about land in the American West than has typically been engaged in the last 150 years. It's exciting. It's audacious. Mm-hmm. It's meaningful for people and wildlife across the continent. And we have many, many supporters that appreciate the work that we're doing, some of whom are supporting the work that we're doing financially. We're almost entirely driven by philanthropic donations. But of course, being something new and novel always, I think, you know, puts up people's antennas a little bit. It attracts attention, particularly in, you know, relatively conservative spaces like agricultural land, or typically seen as agricultural land throughout the Great Plains or the Northern Great Plains. And so sometimes we hear pushback. We're a different idea. We look very different. I live out on American prairie, and certainly I didn't grow up the way that some of my neighbors, my ranching neighbors, grew up. I think we draw attention for that reason, but we also put enormous amount of resources and time into spending time with those neighbors and more distant neighbors to explain kind of what the mission of American prairie is and why we don't see ourselves in any way as a threat to traditional agriculture, either at the, you know, family coffee table level or at the kind of mid-economic level in terms of like regional tax bases, county level politics, that sort of thing. At the end of the day, even 500,000 acres of American prairie is a very small minority of the total land base in the seven counties that we operate. And even things like bison, you know, there's about 900 bison on American prairie right now. There's like 7,000 cattle grazing just on American prairie, not to mention the 500,000 cattle grazing in those seven counties. So American prairie is certainly changing what is available to do and experience in southern Phillips County and some of these other counties in Montana, diversifying, we hope, you know, things to do, things to see, economic, you know, revenue streams, economic opportunities for the communities in the region. But that's different. And different is, I think, always viewed with some skepticism, whether it's in Montana or in Botswana.
Yeah, you're right.
Absolutely. Well, you also act as a liaison to scientists who are conducting research on the reserve. What does that mean? What type of research are they conducting? And why will that be helpful for us in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I appreciate it because it gives me a chance to shout out some of my close partners. I did mention the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute already. They are not our only science partner, but they are our primary science partner. We work with graduate students and researchers from both Montana universities and a number of other universities throughout the country. But Smithsonian and the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute are really kind of the research arm of American prairie. We decided a long time ago that, like, we wanted to be in the business of rewilding public access, buying land for the sake of conservation, not research. That's a different thing, and we didn't want to throw our hat in, and we didn't want to try and reproduce the good work of really powerful scientists. We'd rather partner with them. And who better to partner with than the, you know, world-class scientists at Smithsonian? And so what that means is I work very closely with a number of scientists who are doing the research that informs our management practices. Me and the rest of the staff at American Prairie, our job is to rewild the landscape, steward the resource, the habitat, and manage that for public access. We want to do that based on the best available science. And much of that science has already been done. There are libraries full of graduate dissertations and published research papers and textbooks, et cetera, on prairie ecology. But there's a lot of questions that we still don't know the answers to, or don't have the specific answers that we would like as managers to do our work. And that's where Smithsonian comes in. They are doing work on primary prairie ecology, so just answering fundamental questions about how prairies work, how they are being affected by climate change, all kinds of different other big high-level research questions like that. But also in that process, answering specific research management questions that we have about how to do our job to the best of our abilities as rewilders. And that's just something that we cannot do on our own. And so the support from Smithsonian and the other research partners that we have is very welcome.
And doing a nod back to our first guest who was talking about climate change and how obviously there's a ripple effect to all of us for climate change. Yeah. And when you have these scientists who are working to show how it is affecting our earth and why we should care.
Yeah.
I think places like American Prairie can lend a voice to that argument, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's two kind of like big natural, like essentially existential threats going on right now. And right. Climate change is one of them, which everybody's familiar with. And then there's the biodiversity loss crisis, which I think most people are at least somewhat aware of, although it doesn't typically get the same attention as the climate crisis. Those are interlinked crises, certainly. And American Prairie is really designed to address the biodiversity loss crisis in North America. We kind of lost the appetite for making big national parks sometime around the 1950s after we made Grand Teton National Park. We still make them, but they're very small. We never really made a prairie park, certainly not one big enough to house the full complement of prairie ecology. And the beautiful menageries of wildlife that North Americans should be heir to is largely missing. There is nowhere, really, at scale that you can go out on a grassland landscape and see big herds of bison being followed by pronghorn and wolves and grizzly bears and elk grazing and sage grouse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's just gone. And so we think we can bring that back, which is a way of addressing the biodiversity loss crisis. But one of the cool things that we increasingly are learning more about is that prairies are really, really good at sequestering carbon, mm-hmm. grasslands, mm-hmm. to provide a tremendous service in terms of like storing away these greenhouse gases underground. Not as much as forests do. There's just like less of a grass than there is of a tree by weight. And so less places to put carbon, but grasses bury their carbon underground in their roots. Our prairie grasses may only be 12 inches tall above ground, but their root systems can be 8 to 10 feet deep. And so what that means is when a forest burns, all that carbon goes right back into the air and you're kind of back at square one. Whereas when a prairie burns, the grass burns, sure, but its roots remain intact underground. And so while it may not sequester as much carbon as a forest does, it looks like a more stable long-term storage place for it, especially as fire return cycles increase in the face of climate change.
Right.
So for this and other reasons, we're finding that like what we're doing at American Prairie is not only supporting the rewilding of the continent, the Northern Great Plains anyways, but also is contributing to, you know, keeping carbon in the ground so that it's not contributing to greenhouse gases and global warming.
We got to wrap up, unfortunately. Daniel Kinka, he's the Senior Wildlife Restoration Manager at American Prairie. Daniel, website for people to go to learn more and probably see some spectacular photos.
Wonderful photos. Okay. There's even a film about the fox. I'm in love. What is the website?
Yeah, it's AmericanPrairie.org.
Ah.
Prairie, if you're like me, and even after 6.5 years, can't remember how to spell it. It's B-R-A-I-R-I-E. AmericanPrairie.org.
Yes.
You can learn a lot more about us there.
Daniel Kinka, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. We will be back in touch.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Such a great conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right.
Yeah, my pleasure. Take care.
Thank you, too.